Hello.
I'm Lauren.
And I am Ken.
And this is Paradise After Dark.
Duck, duck, duck.
Paradise After Dark is an independent podcast covering true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
missing people,
and every now and then an urban legend.
Please check out our website, paradiseafterdark.com. On the website, you'll find links to all of our episodes, even the archived episodes, our mailing list, merch store, links to our social media, and of course, our Patreon.
We also have a cool little virtual tip jar there, so if you want to swing by the website and drop off a little tip, we'll give you a shout out on the show. And speaking of shout outs, we'd like to give a warm Paradise After Dark thank you to Monty from, well, the United States.
Yeah. Somewhere in the United
somewhere.
States.
Somewhere. Smart guy.
Yeah.
You know, when you're talking on true crime, you don't really want people to know your first name or where you live because they will research you.
Thank you, Monty, for your tip. And so we have a special guest here in the studio with us. And if you've been a Paradise After Dark listener for a long time, you will remember our buddy, Christopher Balzano.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
You hopefully remember fondly.
I'm sure fondly. He is our resident expert on cults and urban legends and any type of, how do I want to say it?
Anything that within, that might touch on true crime, but that even makes those people roll their eyes, that's what I'm an expert in.
Yes, there we go, there we go, there we go. So we have brought Chris in.
Well, that's a great fine line because then you get that true crime aspect along with the paranormal aspect. So it's kind of like that people that kind of balance and teeter. Of course, being a Libra, that's all I'm about.
And being a Gemini, I jump between the two of them.
There you go. Often,
so. And being a Scorpio, I'll kill you both. All right. So we brought Chris in for this episode, which I think is going to turn into a two-parter because we are going to dive deep into the Ocala National Forest and all of the stories and topics.
All the things that make the Ocala someplace that causes nightmares and that makes you want to go there and yet still avoid it.
I like that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's how I'm selling what I do here.
That's what he said.
There's something weird about the Ocala that is both seductive and repulsive at the same time.
Right. That is a great analogy, yes. And I'll preface this and say that I have a route that I drive at least once a month that brings me about a 60-mile stretch through the Ocala National Forest. And I will admit, it does raise the hair on the back of your neck.
Yeah.
There's just something, you know, I see these all these little turnoffs and I'm like, oh, I wonder what's going on down there or I wonder what's going on up there. It's like, I don't know. And there's a couple little towns, but I won't stop. Even if I am like about to pee my pants, I still won't stop.
Right. And who knows what the name of that town might be or what it was 20 years ago or what it'll be 20 years from now. That's the crazy part about Central Florida.
So they changed their names?
Yeah. Often,
I didn't even know often. That.
And I know you love your research. So imagine trying to do this research and you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And people will reference one of the stories in my book, the person said, oh, this is Rosewood, Florida, and there is no such place as Rosewood, Florida, or at least not in that area. There's one on the West Coast, which kind of connects, but it ended up being that it was the town maybe of Paisley.
So it's one of those where it alters and changes, so now it's got a new name, but she remembers it as that. It's like certain roadways in town.
Yeah,
like
here except for the fact in this case, the area was never called Rosewood.
Oh, but she remembers it as Road.
Yeah.
Okay, that's weird.
Yeah.
That is weird. So the reason we have brought Chris here is because Chris just released his latest book, which is titled
Haunted Ocala National Forest.
How appropriate.
Yes.
Can we get any better than that for this topic?
No, it's part of the Haunted America series, which fits into the narrative of what we're going to be talking about. It's part of the Haunted America series. And so every single book in that series is called Haunted Tampa, Haunted Daytona, Haunted Orlando.
Well, I just found out this evening that Chris actually has like 252 books. How many was it?
10.
10. Okay. I was a little off. I was a little off, but I was trying to give you some props.
It feels like I've got 200.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not, if you read one, you'll like it. You'll probably most likely want to grab another one.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's somewhat confining to write a Haunted America series book. in that it's for a very specific audience. If you go into a Walmart, Walgreens, Walmart, CVS, as opposed to even just a bookstore, you're going to see it on a rack. So it, you can't get too experimental, you know?
Right, yeah.
And my publishers didn't stop me, but it's going to become important to what we're talking about tonight, the fact that, like, you know, this is a ghost book, or for me, a haunted legends book. And so I couldn't write about all the things that I wanted to write about, or that I initially wanted to write about when I made it. But it's a great book if you like a ghost book. But I had to avoid some of the true crime unless it specifically had to do with the hauntings or the haunted legend.
So we're gonna get into all of it tonight, which is why I said I think this is gonna become a two-parter. I do actually know that Chris can be a little long-winded as well.
I'm a storyteller. And you know what? Like, honestly,
that's what we love about it. That's what we love about it.
That's why I love you guys. It was intimidating. I don't know if you saw my social media post today, but it was like intimidating because you guys do such a great job with the research and being like spot on with the details. And I'm a storyteller. I'm a folklorist. It's like, who cares if the details change? And I'm like, no, I'm doing the true crime part of it. So I have to make sure, like, all my ducks are in a row. So, you know, if I get any of my facts wrong tonight, I'm sure you guys will either correct me or your listeners will.
Well, don't worry too much about that. It's all good. Our listeners know that this is a folklore episode. It's a strange place episode. It's an urban legend episode. I don't quite know how I'm going to categorize it, but
yeah,
we'll see where it goes.
I think we're going to hit upon a lot of different things tonight, and some of them leak into folklore and urban legends and ghosts, and some of them are just straight. This is a place where killers thrive.
Right. Okay. Chris, so let's get into it. I'm kind of going to let you take the lead here because you are the expert.
Wow. That's a threatening or an intimidating tag to give.
Did we want to get involved with asking about the Rainbow People first, or is there a certain topic you want to lead in with? Because I'm curious about the Rainbow People.
I think how I got to write the book is going to naturally lead
okay. to some of that. All right. Let's do that.
All right. So about 15 years ago, I was doing a lot of research in this place called the Bridgewater Triangle in Massachusetts. I didn't know that it was the Bridgewater Triangle yet. I was just doing research and all was in the same area. And my boss came in to me at work. I was working in a library. He said to me, "Have you ever heard of Freetown, Massachusetts?" And I'm like, "No." And he's like, "Research it." And he kind of like went like this. And he went, "Oh, and you might want to look at this weird like ghost detective or something that's out there." And then he left. So anytime your boss says you can put your work down and do work and do like research on ghosts and stuff, you know you've got a good job.
I'm in.
Never should have left it, but what are you going to do? And so I started to research this town of Freetown, which is one of the apexes of the Bridgewater Triangle. So your listeners might know the Bridgewater Triangle because it's become really popular in the last couple of years.
Well, we just covered not too long ago the Bermuda Triangle. Right. So is it sort of similar?
It's an area in Massachusetts, southeastern Mass, and into Rhode Island, depending on how you define it, which has all these anything in the paranormal or supernatural you could imagine. Bigfoot and Pukwudgies and Thunderbirds and pterodactyls and ghosts and zombies. And they're all about the number of things that are in that area. It's a higher concentration than anywhere else in the country. And so it draws this weird stuff in, right? And so I started to do research on Freetown, and I found that Freetown was like the center of the Bridgewater Triangle. Even though it's one of the apexes, like everything in the Bridgewater Triangle was also happening in Freetown. But in addition to it, it had a ridiculously high number of crimes, of murders that were attached to it, right? Because it has this Freetown State Forest. And the idea of it is you could be in the Freetown State Forest in an hour, right? Like if you were in Boston, Providence, Rhode Island, these kind of bigger cities in New England, you can commit some crime there and you can dump the body in the Freetown State Forest within an hour. And you're in the middle of nowhere and there's nothing. And in addition to that, as I started to do more research, I came across this guy named Alan Alves, right? And so Alan Alves is he was a deputy in or detective, I should say, in Freetown. Like all the towns we're going to talk about tonight, that's Freetown. These small little towns where nothing goes on, where nothing happens, where like you don't even see cops on the road, right? And yet he was involved in over 30 homicide investigations in the time that he was there, right? Because so many crimes were happening. And
that's a lot for a small town.
It's a crazy amount. And I'm not going to say the majority of them, but a lot of them and a lot of other weird things that were going on had a cult twist to it, right? So there were suggestions of some kind of ritualistic nature to the murders, or it very specifically, there were cults. I mean, one of the cases that he worked is called, you know, the cult murders. And so he had to become an expert in it. And so this guy, this little town in Massachusetts for a while became the leading authority on cult crime in the United States, and was called all over the country to consult other police departments. And Iceland, he had to go over to Iceland because they were having an issue with something. Like, he was an authority. And well, so this is definitely something that was going on. So it wasn't fake.
Well, one of the things I think a lot of people in the true crime genre forget about is that there is such a thing as that, like you said, the cult crime. They think in cults, it's all about paranormal, spiritual. It's not necessarily the case. A lot of times it is a setup for crime.
And what you don't understand, which we can talk about when we start getting into more specifically Ocala, because it's even worse in Ocala, is this idea that when people think cults, they think either teenagers running around listening to heavy metal music and drinking blood, which we do have that.
Satanic panic.
Right. Or they think of guys in robes who are just like wackos, or they think molestation.
But not the Hellfire Club.
Right. It's funny because I have to keep telling people, like, the satanic panic was a real thing.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that that stuff wasn't going on. You know, like, it might not have been that Dungeons and Dragons was brainwashing your kids, but the amount of cult crime that was going on in the 80s and early 90s was real. And in addition to that, it didn't stop. It just got better. And of course, by better, I don't mean that it's good. I just mean that they got better at hiding it. They got more sophisticated and they went more underground. The number one thing that Alan Iles taught me was when they discover a cult, they're not really seeing the cult, right? And so that's the thing that we have to constantly keep in mind as I talk about some of these things, especially with the Rainbow People, is that the sophistication of what's going on here and what it has its fingers in is pretty – it's elaborate. It's well-planned. It's thought out. And oftentimes, the people who are involved in it don't even realize that that's what they're doing. And so with all of that in the back of my mind as I'm looking at these cases and all of this crime that's happening in Freetown, and of course, all of these ghost sightings, right, and zombie sightings and strange things that were happening there – I started to wonder, is there a connection between those things, right? And so if you look at the Bridgewater Triangle, 24, which is like the backbone, I say, of the Bridgewater Triangle, Route 24, has more fatal accidents per accidents at that time than anywhere else in the United States. Bridgewater State Hospital has like 15 times as many suicides as other mental health facilities. The rate of teen suicide in that area is dramatically higher than anywhere else in the state and probably in the country.
Wow.
The number of divorces, the divorce rate, like all these crazy things which are not related to these little ghost stories that I'm looking into, and it's like flashing lights. And so when I wrote Dark Woods, the question was, can the same energy or the same juice that is causing all this paranormal activity, can it somehow be drawing in and even like feeding off of the negativity of crime, right? Like, can it actually be some kind of cursed area that pulsates negativity where people who are into nasty things find their way there, right? Because, you know, for example, there was a person who abducted a teenager and he passed by plenty of places where he could have dumped her body. And instead, he drove out of his way to go to Freetown. And then, depending on who you ask, ritualistically kill her. And so this is, you know, like, why didn't he stop at any of the other places, any other forest that he could have along the way? It's almost as if he were called to it. So that was the question of Dark Woods.
Well, with, you know, like when you get into Boston, you get into Massachusetts, anytime someone talks Massachusetts and spiritual stuff, I go back to like the Salem witch trials.
Yeah.
It seems like that's really the only place where the witches seem to always be. So for some reason, there's something very mysterious in and of itself about that area.
Well, one of the things that is in the Bridgewater Triangle, Freetown specifically, that also is reflective in the Ocala, is this idea that people who are working the entire spectrum of witchcraft, right? People who are doing good things, people who are doing negative things, find that when they go to these locations, their casting is more powerful, right? The juice is amped up in it. And so they actually seek these places out. Now, that's part of the seductive and yet repulsive part, because oftentimes people who are workers of witchcraft, and I'm using that in the most broadest term, neo-paganism, find these little spots, right? Like they find them like a metal detector. It's like an energy detector.
Yeah.
They gravitate towards them naturally. And when I was actually writing Dark Woods, I was able to track one arm of the cult through Salem or the area of Salem, the county that Salem is in, up through over the years. I was actually literally able to track like the arms of them moving through and then kind of settling in Freetown.
It kind of reminds me of Casadega, Florida.
Casadega. Yeah. Okay, so Casadega I consider in the shadow of the Ocala.
Okay.
I don't mention the book because it's its own thing. but it's one of those things where, you know, at some point we'll define what I mean by the Ocala. But there are a lot of places who, for example, Gainesville, right? Like you wouldn't naturally think if you know Florida that Gainesville's not in the Ocala National Forest. And yet when I was talking to someone, she was telling me the story, which is in the book, about, you know, her boyfriend was in the hospital. She had this crazy paranormal experience. And then I'm like, oh, that's really crazy. Thank you for sharing. Why are you telling me? She's like, well, because it was the forest. I'm like, well, what do you mean it was the forest? She said, I just got the feeling that whatever was in my house was born somehow in the forest. So a lot of people who are not traditionally in the forest, right, like not in the trees, still consider themselves in the shadow of the Ocala. I call it the shadow of the Ocala. For example, Sumner County is not that far away, right? But they have the Green Swamp, right? Like the Green Swamp is their thing, and the Ocala is the Ocala, and yet
we've covered, I want to say, 2-3 cases, and I think all of them were child murders in Sumter County.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because sometimes I listen to your episodes, and I'm like, all right, yep, that's the shadow of the Ocala, the shadow of the Ocala, when you talk about them. But when I talk to people from Sumter, they are like, yeah, we suffer from the same thing. So I had probably about, I know this is boring, but 15,000 words that were just Sumner County stuff that I cut out because I was like, I almost have enough for like another book with this stuff. But it's important to keep in mind that those two places are connected by phosphorus mines. So the very first time I went to Astor, Florida, right? And so Astor is in the Ocala, right? Like if you drive down the main roads of Astor, you're going to find, the Ocala National Forest signs, right? First time I went there, I was there with my co-host at the time. They begged me almost to go and do an event there. And I wasn't even really that far into doing Tripping on Legends. And so I went there and the very first thing I noticed was that the light wasn't moving the right way, right? Like there was just something weird about it. It kind of had this like glazy look to it. Every time we took a picture and it was bright sunshine, right? It was, it was 11 o'clock. All the pictures came out shadowy. Right. They all came out dark. It was like, why are we dark, dark, dark? And then the weirdest part was we were talking and we weren't much further apart than you guys are now from me. And it was echoing. Right. And it was weird because it's not someplace that would echo. We're talking like we're in trees and stuff like that. We're in a parking lot, but, it's surrounded by trees or buildings.
Are you sure somebody didn't slip you something?
That's what it felt like. And I'm like, there is something weird about this place. And then as I was doing the actual event, I'm talking about ghost legends, and everyone, and it's a small town, everyone in the crowd, everyone in the audience had a story to tell, and they were all completing each other's sentences, and they were all adding to a legend. Oh, yeah, no, that's not that, that's the monk that got murdered, and blah. Oh, yeah, you mean the guy that's over on this street? Oh, yeah, and they were, and I was like, this is a town that has just totally accepted the fact that crazy things are going on, it's completely haunted. The more I did research, the more I started to find out that it was almost exactly like Freetown, but Freetown amped up like on steroids, in that it's larger. And then I started to get these little bit of hints and see these little bit of signs that there were cult activity too. And the more I pressed and the more I started to see that there was a lot more crime going through the state forest, going mainly west to east, but like a lot of weird things going on. And everyone kept mentioning, when I would say a ghostly legend, they would say, oh, but how about, you know, the cult that's supposed to be active there? How about this? How about that? How about the rainbow people? And I started to realize that this book could be Dark Woods too. You know, yeah, it could be like, oh my God, it's like the same exact place. Until I started to dig more and more into things, I started to notice things, and it became too much. Like, the rabbit holes were just too much. Once again, it's supposed to be a cute little ghost book, and here I am going to be starting talking about, you know, biker gangs from Daytona and serial killers and child, you know, abduction cases. And as I'm watching TV, it seemed like every night I was hearing the Ocala. And actually, you and I were messaging, Lauren, and there were a few at that time. There were like four missing women, and all of them at one point or another, the story talked about the Ocala or a town surrounding the Ocala. And I was like, this is just too much to tackle. This is not that kind of book. I'm going to push it off to the side, but I'm going to make sure I use it as context so people understand that there's something very weird going on in the forest. And then there's this other element to it that someone is either taking advantage of that or drawn in by that.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and get into the meat of these stories.
Okay, welcome back. So, Chris, we were talking about cults.
Yeah.
Certain things like that. So kind of tell us a little bit about how, you know, the cults and this kind of all leads into the Ocala National Forest and everything.
And probably the best example you can use, because it's the one that's it's the one that people in these towns that surround the Ocala and are in the Ocala kind of live in fear of, would be the rainbow people. You can't talk to anyone from that area without them mentioning the rainbow people. And when they do, they first talk about it on a nuisance level. Right? Like how annoying it is. And then if they open up, they start to say that there's something sinister going on there as well. Right? So they're a really good example of what I'm talking about when I talk about cults.
This is not like the Woodstock people that show up. I mean, this is legit cults.
Well, I mean, okay. So let's start off by saying that there is something weird going on paranormally in the forest, right? Supernaturally is probably a better way to say it. There's this thing that I call the shift. And this shift, and you can relate to this, things aren't always in the same exact place in the forest. So you can have people who have been dirt biking on trails for decades. Then all of a sudden, the trail that they've been going on their whole life isn't there. But then it's there 2 weeks later. Or hunters are out there, fishermen. They mark off on their GPS where something is, even where they put stands. They go there. And it's not there. And then a month later, they go there and it is there. So there's a changing, shifting geography that happens in the forest itself that can't be denied. And if you talk to anybody in that area and you talk about it, they just kind of give you like a knowing look, like, yeah, you just know it. Cemeteries all the time. I have one story in the book about a girl who sometimes had a cemetery in the woods behind her house, and sometimes the cemetery wasn't there. Losing time. People go in. And then they come out and 20 hours have passed, or they go in and it's not the same day.
You know, when you say lose time, that's happened to me one time. I've had one out of body experience, and I've had one time where I literally lost time. So I get what you're saying.
It's, you know, the people, once again, because people do a lot of dirt biking there. Dirt bikers are riding on, they're behind their friends, then they're not behind their friends. They get back to the house and the guy's like, where have you been for the last 4 hours? He's like, I was on the same trail as you guys. I don't know why I'm here 4 hours later. So the shifting geography, as well as this kind of like ability to lose time, and for, like I said, the waves to go on. I actually have a few stories of people who were not in the Ocala and then all of a sudden, boom, woke up in the Ocala. We need to understand that in the context of all of this that we're going to talk about with cults, there are people who believe that is a byproduct of dark forces that are working in the forest, dark human forces that have raised something. I know I'm kind of going off the reservation here, but you understand what I'm saying. And then some people who believe that has always been there and they're using it.
Well, how does that relate to the rainbow people?
Because these rainbow people seem to appear and disappear at will. They seem to have marked off certain territories where things are more intense. So where this kind of pulse comes from it. We're going to move on from it and talk about the true crime aspects of things, but it's important to understand that there is something supernatural happening there, right? Like, the Rainbow People are not inherently bad at all. As a matter of fact, you could say they're kind of what we should aspire to.
Okay, so before we go on, I kind of want to give our listeners a little lowdown on exactly who, what the Rainbow People are and what we're talking about. So the Rainbow Gatherings are temporary, loosely knit communities of people who congregate in remote forests around the world for one or more weeks at a time. And every February, they do congregate in the Ocala National Forest. They are supposedly a group of peace-loving, hippie types.
It was inspired by Woodstock. Directly inspired by Woodstock.
Well, and they go back to the 70s.
Yeah, and actually influenced by the 1960s counterculture and non-commercial rock festivals of the early 70s, the Rainbow Gathering and the Rainbow Family of Living Light, usually abbreviated to Rainbow Family, claim to express utopian impulses, bohemianism, hipster, and hippie culture. The gatherings have roots clearly traceable to the counterculture of the 60s. Now, Rainbow Gatherings have their own jargon, which helps to create a sense of community and express their thoughts on society and social injustice. In particular, mainstream society is commonly referred to and viewed as Babylon, a term from the Christian New Testament, connoting the participants' widely held belief that modern lifestyles and systems of government are unhealthy, unsustainable, exploitative, and out of harmony with the natural system of the planet. And Chris, you may continue.
Yeah. So and there are two locations in Florida where they have it. So it originally started, the first one was in 1972. The first one in Florida was in 1973. So it's a really big deal for the next one. Most of them happen in July. They happen in February here. 50th anniversary this year. The Ocala's one and the Apalachicola. I'm horrible with pronouncing things, but that's going to become important later. So let's remember that word.
Apalachicola.
Which I think, based on the website, they seem to have not done it for a while. So I'm not sure if it's still active there. But it's definitely, you know, one of those situations where at one point both of these state forests were active.
Have you seen their actual website?
Yeah.
It is like from 1994.
Or like GeoCities.
Right.
Yeah, cool. But that's because, you know, that's not what they do. Like, it's one of those things you were talking about, the slang they use. Like, it's a culture in and of itself. Like, oftentimes what goes on for non-Florida Rainbow People, what goes on in the real world is only the filling until the next ceremony, right? And they're very anti-technology, some of them. So it makes sense they need a centralized place so people can get information, but they're not spending a lot of time on TikTok.
Right, okay.
Right? I mean, because, you know, there is, and we need to be very clear on this. The Rainbow People are not inherently bad, right? Like, it's not one of those situations where they are criminals or doing anything. Every year, law enforcement, they've had across the country and in the other, not so much in the other countries, but there's always been an element of crime to it, right? Because anytime you get thousands and thousands of people together, things are going to happen. But
right.
For the most part, they're neater than most campers in the woods.
Okay, so
not during the time of the festival, but they are very much into the idea of, like, you don't leave a footprint when you leave.
So what makes them a problem?
Well, the first part of it is that they're the ones in Florida don't go. They don't leave. There are people who are Rainbow People who stay in the forest. Now, if you're, like, first one was in Colorado, right? If you're in Colorado, you're not staying in the woods after, you know, come fall, right?
Right.
But in Florida, they've learned to adjust and live off the land. So if you talk to people who are in any facet of the retail industry, they tell you that the Rainbow People come out of those woods, and everyone in for example, Astor, everyone in DeLand knows when you go to CVS or when you go to Walgreens, you always check the deodorant to make sure it hasn't, the seal hasn't been broken.
Oh, right? Yeah.
So, you know, there is this idea that they're a nuisance for that time, but there seems to be a lingering on of the rainbow people in the Ocala that adds a different aspect to it. And then people will talk about going out to do their trash, and they'll look, and there'll be the sound of someone standing in their yard, right?
That's not creepy at all.
And with a lot of this, with a lot of these connections that I'm going to make tonight, it's important to understand, too, that it's the impression, right, of the rainbow people that is as important as anything they might do. So just like that girl with the ghost in the house in Gainesville, when someone sees someone creepy on their land, when they go out to smoke a butt at 2 o'clock in the morning because they can't fall asleep, and they see three people in the woods staring up at the house, they think that they're rainbow people automatically. When someone walks across, and I've had dozens of conversations like that, people, there's someone walking up their driveway or walking down their driveway away from their house, and they seem to just disappear. And their mind goes to, was it a ghost or was it rainbow people? So they live in this this kind of programmed sense of danger or sense of something's going to happen, anticipation, because
the rainbow
locals, because the rainbow people don't go away. So that's one element to it. Because of the nature of what the rainbow people do, you have the influence of drugs. You have the influence of things like crystal meth and LSD and marijuana. So people are scared for their children going in. They're not rainbow people, but hey, I want to score some meth. I'm going to go into the woods. And then those kids maybe don't return. Or they get hooked, right? The access is easier. And then it's like, well, you know, while the concepts and the ideas of the rainbow people are communal, right? Like, I share this, there's no money, right? Like, during the gatherings, there's no money. It's, you give me this, I'll give you this, and we'll all do it. There is also this idea that it's been infiltrated, right? So the rainbow people, who are your typical people most times out of the year, can be easily influenced. So not only can I, as someone who is nefarious, go in and manipulate people and maybe turn them to things that I want, but also I can use what they're doing. Now they're going back to these other places as a way to kind of spread ideas and also spread materials so that they reach further.
So you're talking about like real cults.
Yeah. So when I talk about cults, I'm not talking about some people who get together, have kinky sex, maybe drink each other's blood and say, Hail Satan.
No.
So that's important to understand.
So there's no Kool-Aid involved like Jim Jones.
There's something in the Kool-Aid, but it's not poison for sure. So, you know, the best example I can give, and I hate to do this, but it's maybe the easiest frame of reference. And I want you to keep in mind that this has been years of research. So I'm not just some weirdo with a tin hat who's been doing this. This is, you know, I recognize these patterns because I spent years researching this, working on the first book, and then consulting with people and things like that.
He is wearing a hat, but we cannot confirm if it's lined with foil or not.
It is most definitely not. So think of it in terms of like the Illuminati, right?
Okay.
Think of it in terms of things like that. So it is a highly organized triangle type situation where the majority of the people who are involved in the cult don't know that they're involved in the cult, right? So one of the things that this kind of society does, this kind of organization does, is they infiltrate other organizations. So if you're running an organization, say it's Florida-based, which it's not, right? It's bigger than that. You don't say, let's go in the woods and do our ceremonies. They do that. That's a natural part of things, right? But what they do is they send members off to, let's say, the KKK. Let's say they send their members off to biker gangs. Biker gangs, especially in Florida, is a huge part of what's going on here. They send their kids off to go lead, you know, the Boy Scouts of America. And these people who they send out are never the commanders. They're never the captains. They're always the lieutenants who are saying, hey, maybe we should be doing this, or maybe we can lead things this way. I was doing a major study, being a high school teacher, talking about most of these types of cults have infiltrated the gangs, right? So if you look at occult symbolism and then you look at like Crip, Blood, Vice Lord symbolism, it's all the same. They use the same imagery, right? They use the same structures. So you go in and you say like, okay, well, we're going to infiltrate the Crips, right? And so that's how you gain control. So in the same way, you have these people who are now coming into, and this is different levels, coming into the Rainbow People to influence them to hey, you know, and we were talking, these are people who are highly suggestible. They're people who are
very trusting. Under the influence.
Yeah, yeah. And if you lean things the right way, it's easy to move a large group of people like this. It's very important to keep in mind that these kinds of cults have been active for years. They just sometimes shift what they're doing. So if you look, for example, the number of missing children that then somehow in the story, the Ocala comes up, that's because it's all part of the organization. It's not these people. And even some of the people we're going to talk about tonight, it's like, were they directed without knowing that they were being directed? Were they influenced? It's really hard to tell. But if you take a step back and you know a few of the signs, you can see some of it.
If you think about it in the Ocala area, in the Rainbow People in the Ocala area, which case would you say kind of brings more of the criminal aspect to that?
Well, you know, when I posted in a Florida history, it wasn't even specifically in Ocala, I posted in Florida history, does anyone have any spooky stories about the Ocala? And I got hundreds of responses. I wish I got hundreds of like the response that I got on my normal posts. Like, please download my episode. But these people responding and arguing with each other, arguing with me, talking about things. Two cases, maybe because of how recent they were, two cases kept coming up time and time again. And they were the ones that I almost included, but it was one of those things where it was just too fresh because they're still missing and they're still, you know, possible. And the first one is Robert Ryan Snowbird. And this is kind of one of those, it's one of those cases where everything is aligned that this kid just disappeared off the face of the planet, that there was just something going on. This was in February. So February, now we're talking like that's when the Rainbow People are here.
Exactly. The timeline
of 2019. He had all these nicknames. He was kind of a light guy. He was depressed, right? But his nicknames were out there. I had people call him Muffin, too. Like, this was a guy that people seemed to like. He had a girlfriend, but he was also troubled. A few weeks before he went missing, he had a suicide attempt. He came out of the hospital, and he was like, I'm going into the woods. Rainbow People, I'm going to go into the woods. I'm going to, you know, kind of get my head straight. And he hooked up with the Rainbow People, right? After he was missing for a few weeks, then they couldn't find him. His girlfriend was straight out like, yeah, yeah, we hooked up with the Rainbow People. We were living with them for a while. And then he said he was going off. So he left his girlfriend and he supposedly left her. Now, that's the official kind of timeline and story. And he's never been seen again. He was 27 at the time. In these correspondence that I had with people, they would talk about the fact that in their minds, the Rainbow People were 100% involved. That they had heard that he was recruited by them, that he was being taken away to go someplace else. These are all, once again, rumors, but it's the kind of stuff that swirls around these cases.
Well, one thing to note about the Rainbow People, too, is they claim that there's no leaders, there's no one in charge. But it's funny how they go to these events and things happen. So it's like people bring food, people build stuff. You can't organize something like that without having some sort of chain of command. It would seem to me. I mean, how do
they
you,
seem to have a council?
Exactly.
And but then what happens is
they
that,
claim there's nobody in charge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it is a kind of a natural flow of things. They actually have their own police force that kind of is volunteer. Like, I couldn't get too much information on how these people were made, but they are called the – wait, I got to flip back here. They are called the Shantisana, and they are essentially – they're the go-betweens, the liaisons with the local police. So the local police have an issue with it, something like that. But then they also solve disputes that are in the camps, that are during the gatherings.
Well, and somebody's got to pull these permits.
Yeah, they do it every year. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's right. So it's more of like it's more of like if you and I were going camping and you said, hey, you bring the beer, I'll bring the burgers. more than in a bigger scale than, you know, me saying like, hey, I'm in charge now, you are going to bring the beer. It's just kind of one of those things that naturally synergetically flows from it.
Yep. Okay.
And I think the people who have been there the longest take natural leadership roles without officially being leaders. But I also want to stress, in this case that we're talking about, in Robert's case, it's not a matter of that the Rainbow people took him. It's an element that is within those that group that is these people think have kind of taken him. So, you know, you don't really know what happened to him. But and it's a large area. He could have done anything. He could have gone into one of the springs, which his body won't be found for a while. But the fact that people who were intimately connected to him were connecting with me, a stranger, and saying, I mean, they were saying, you should do a book just on him, or you have to dedicate a whole chapter to this, and it's the Rainbow people, adds to this kind of mystique and this weirdness that people feel about it. I was talking earlier about alarm systems. So one person contacted me and said, you know that these centers are close because you start to see spoons hanging from the trees, very Blair Witch. You start to see these spoons hanging from the trees. And then when the spoons stop, they start getting to these hooks like that you would have in the back of a trailer. That are designed specifically to just like mess up with vehicles. That's when you start to get into the Rainbow people who aren't necessarily Rainbow people who are doing scarier stuff there. And so many people were contacting me saying that they think he and him, because of his depression, because of things like that, was more susceptible, and that he was either recruited and now he's out somewhere else, or that he had been abducted and sold.
See, in what little bit of research I pulled out, it seemed to me that the Rainbow people were genuinely just a decent group of people that were just trying to be out free-spirited. But of course, like anything else, when you get a massive amount of people, it definitely changes the aspect.
With no organized structure, like you said.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people use it as sort of a facade to sort of infiltrate the Rainbow people themselves and create this underlying criminal aspect to the Rainbow people, or maybe this, the lieutenant you said earlier, they want to create this like hidden agenda within the Rainbow people.
They want to forward that hidden agenda. Yeah. And once again, keep in mind that, you know, that these places, because there's no, you sign in, you have a reservation because of those things. People only know that someone has gone missing because, or within the Rainbow Gathering, if people know that they're at the Rainbow Gathering. So someone who is maybe not necessarily, you know, social media connected or something like that, or they can go to the gathering, if they disappear, no one knows.
Well, one thing people need to understand with the Rainbow people too is they're not a small group. This is not 500 people. We're talking anywhere from 10 to up to 50,000 people.
Yeah. I'm not sure if the Florida one has ever gotten to 50, but they regularly seem to hit that 7 to 15.
I think the ones I was researching, like you get into Utah, up in that area, Utah, Oregon, that's where it kind of started in that area. You get into the 50,000.
But once again, you really don't know how many people there because there's no census. And like I said, some of the people don't go. Some of the people don't leave.
True.
And so it's – and of course, if you're just in the forest and you never go, you know, you're homeless or whatever, you might be misidentified as a Rainbow person. But because there's no structure to it, there's no follow up on it, you don't know whether that person is just some guy living in the woods or whether they're a Rainbow person.
And that's one of the things that can be so mysterious about Robert's disappearance, is because we know he was there, but what aspects
and
was
that he
involved
was interacting
in?
With them? Yeah.
What aspects was he involved in? I mean, who did he contact? Who was the last person to see him? Those things are kind of tough because these people aren't necessarily always in the right frame of mind to remember those things. And there's so many people. I mean, they refer to each other as brother and sister or sibling, however. And sometimes that can really mess with, you know, the whole investigation, if you will, because there's no definitive answer as to who was the last person to see him because he saw everybody.
Yeah. And being local, he knew what to expect there. Like there would definitely be a reason why. Coming out of a suicide attempt, coming out of a hospitalization, that's where he would want to go.
Yeah.
Because he was of a certain mindset or wanted to shift his mindset. And he thought that would be the best place to do it. Meaning he was susceptible to a lot, or maybe stuff had happened before.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll talk about – we got one more case you want to talk about?
Yeah. I've got one more that was constantly brought up. Yeah.
Okay. And we are back.
Welcome back.
So
I am a high school teacher.
You are. You are. I always forget that.
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Cartier.
So we have one more case you want to talk about.
Yeah, at least directly related that people.
Let's go into that.
And in the same way that the other one, the Silverger was, the details of this case are sketchy, right? So when you're dealing with a lot of these cases, you have people who are living sketchy lifestyles. And of course, we look at true crime people, researchers, we look at it from, 12 years ago or 11 years ago for this one. We're looking back at it and we can pull these things out, these little details. But it's, for a lot of people, it's just the lifestyle, right? It's just where they were at that moment or what it was. But there are elements to the case, and her name is Lacey Bonnefell. And I always pronounce things wrong, so if you know her or relate connected to her, I'm sorry. Who went missing in 2011, at the tail end of 2011. She was 25 at the time, and she went missing out of Altoona, which I have a whole bunch of research just on crazy unexplained things in Altoona, like mysterious fires and
I've heard some odd stuff there.
Also, if you're into it, I'm not sure if you are, there's a thing known as the name game. Made popular by Lauren Coleman, who actually also named the Bridgewater Triangle. If you go to places with the same name in different areas, you find the same kind of activity. Altoona is one of those places that, all throughout the country, these towns of Altoona have something weird going on in them. But she was 25. People kind of considered her like a drifter. Like, she wasn't really focused on what she was doing. She had three daughters. It didn't seem to have, this is once again, according to people who talk to me, so I don't want to offend, but like that she just didn't have things together, but she was by no means off the rails.
Very free spirited.
Free spirited.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I like the way you, so she was at Big Scrub, which is in Altoona, and her car got stuck in the sand. Right. So she's driving with her friend whose name is Terry McDowell. And the car gets stuck in the sand, and she says, I'm going to go find help, right? So I know this sounds like the beginning of a horror story, right? And then the feet are dangling and hitting the roof or something like that.
Right.
So she goes off to find help. Now, this is 2011, right? So it already kind of seems like it's kind of a sketchy situation.
Why is she driving through that area in a car?
Because you do. Especially if you grew up in the area.
It wasn't a car. It was a Ford Ranger, which is basically a car.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That makes a little bit more sense. But yeah, like, I want to know what she's doing there in the first place.
So I was doing I was doing a case following up on the Coyote Woman, which is a legend that I was talking about in Rosewood, Paisley. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, and we drove this road to it. And I had some friends of mine take me out there who live in Sumner County and who are very, woods oriented and have been in the forest a million times. And I could not consider myself driving my car the way that they were driving their car through the woods the way that they were with complete confidence. When that is your lifestyle, that's just your lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, I'm a city boy, so I wouldn't even conceive of going into the woods with my car like that. The one time I did, exploring a ghostly legend, my car blew up. You know what I'm saying? So, like, but if that's the way you grew up, then you're doing it, and also the type of car would facilitate it being a situation anyway. But the weird thing is, it's like, why not use your cell phone? Why not contact someone? Why? And what kind of help are you getting to get a car out of the mud? You know what I'm saying? Like, it was just very sketchy. She had a history of drugs. So it was kind of she disappeared. She was never seen again.
Well, Terry McDowell apparently was killed in a meth lab explosion.
Yeah, I was getting to that.
In 2013.
Yes.
So
the whispers, once again, the whispers that people were telling me was that he was connected somehow to the Rainbow People and that she was sold off. It was a case of human trafficking.
I was going to ask about that. So we get into the human trafficking part, which we know. I'll be honest. When we went to CrimeCon, we went to New Jersey. We went to CrimeCon Austin. It seems like these posters for human trafficking are becoming more prevalent.
In all of the airports.
Yeah, everywhere. I'm literally sitting you know, I'm sitting in an airport. I see a sign. I go into the bathroom. It's on the urinal. I mean, it's literally all this human trafficking. So this is huge. It's a real thing.
So we have families that are left behind, and families will never stop believing. Families will never stop looking. If you are from Boston, right? If your child goes missing in Boston, you assume that they're dead, right? Because like it's Boston, it's a city. This Ocala, people assume that they're lost. They assume that they've fallen into one of the bodies of water. It is so easy to get from the Ocala. I mean, think about just the sports teams in Florida, right? It is so easy to get from the Ocala to Jacksonville, to Daytona, to Tampa, to Orlando. These are major cities of where you can go anywhere after that. Not to mention, you are hours away from the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico.
And I have actually done extensive research on human trafficking in Florida, and it's not talked about nearly enough, but it is a huge problem that is happening right under our nose in every city, in every small town, in every big city. It is happening in Florida. Florida is one of the biggest states for human trafficking right now in the United States.
And these cults, these nefarious elements within branches of these rainbow people or who are identifying or pretending to be rainbow people in Florida, they're the foot soldiers of this because you just assume that you're just never going to find them again, that they're somewhere in the woods buried. And then, of course, when this happens enough, it's kind of like a shrug. You know, when people hear the stories, I'm trying to think, I heard one story that you guys were doing. And as soon as you mentioned the Ocala, like one of the towns that was around the Ocala, I was like, I know where that kid is. That kid's somewhere in a dark room.
You're right talking now. About Trenton Duckett.
That might be the case, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's I don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now.
Right. But that's what it is. They're all rabbit holes, right? Because
sometimes Lauren will say, okay, we're going to cover this case next, and I get the research. So when you say rabbit hole, it's like I'm literally Alice in fucking Wonderland. It's ridiculous sometimes.
No, I'm with you. And the funny thing is this has been my life for like 3 years, right? Like I signed the contract 2 years ago, but it's really been 3 years that I've been doing this research. Even I, last night, I was like, I got to have my stuff together if I'm going on Paradise After Dark, Dark, Dark. And I was like, it took me hours. Like, I didn't even get to do my writing last night because I was like, page after page after page of these things that I'm making connections on. And it's just, I think that there's a sense of, well, you know what it is. You know what's going on there. And they shrug it off, and those cases die faster than they do in other places because there's almost this, I don't want to say acceptance, but this kind of, defeat thing. That body is somewhere in that woods and you're never going to find it.
And I believe, honestly.
But it's not. It's shipped off somewhere.
Well, I believe, honestly, I think law enforcement sometimes, they understand that and they know it.
Yeah.
So when you talk about human trafficking, I think a lot of times the investigators get involved. They go through the case. They check all the facts. They check all the leads. And sometimes it might lead to a human trafficking where they realize, like you just said, all right, they're no longer in Florida jurisdiction anymore. We're not going to find them. We have to wait till they come back or something triggers them to come back here. I mean, would you agree with that? I mean,
yeah, I would also agree that that infiltration I'm talking about is just not on the criminal end of things, but also in law enforcement as well and stuff like that, and slowly influence and stuff. So, you know, you hear
covered some cases,
yeah. and it's and there are a few sketchy characters throughout the history of the Ocala. That you're kind of like, what exactly was that guy thinking?
Yeah.
And it's very subtle and it's very explainable, right? You can explain away the situation and things like that. And yet there's this little, it happens enough times that an outsider over the course of years can kind of see these types of patterns. Yeah. Once again, not wearing a tin hat and not saying anything bad about the, you know, I'm totally pro blue. But it's like the infiltration.
We've discovered, you know, it's like we said before, and I mentioned it on one case, and I got chastised, emailed the shit out of me in one case, where every single, I don't know how you say it, like, you know, we talked about Gacy, who was a clown. Mm-hmm. We talked about Bundy, who was a lawyer, or he was just that, you know, that
yeah.
handsome guy or whatever. So, I mean, they get these people that are in regular jobs. BTK is what I was getting at, not
right. Andy.
But BTK, he was like a deacon at a church. So you get these people that are, you know, regardless, 200 people might be perfect, but you get that one guy that literally just paints everybody in shame. So I understand exactly what you're saying, where you can get it. I mean, here locally, in one of the cases that we just re-released, where we think that maybe that might be the avenue that was taken, you know, so.
Yeah. And is it power hungry? You know, that's, and I think that, cause once again, getting into the socio or the mindset, the psychology, the more that you can explain things away, right? So we can all look at, because we've had our experiences, we've watched the news, we can say, yeah, well, you know, law enforcement attracts people who are power hungry. And so we can explain away something that might be cult related or might be as a bad apple who was power hungry or on an ego trip or something like that, when there might have been something else working out. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, in other words, if you're really good at what you do, then no one knows you're doing it, right? And so we are kind of looking, we can easily find these other explanations for these really deep cults, because there's all these other, they choose situations that other explanations can make just as much sense or more sense, especially because we don't want to believe anyone has that kind of control.
So where does the Lacey Buenafil case stand now?
You don't want to be connected to it. Six people. So, McDowell and then five other people connected with the case have all died. Now, once again, you can say she was running in circles of people who were drug addicts or who were leading lifestyles that weren't necessarily healthy. We're talking 11 years later. Six people connected to the case have all died.
That's frightening.
Yeah. You know, so that's, once again, I think what adds to this idea that it was some kind of cult activity. And of course, when you talk cults to locals, they point
so
to the Rainbow
People. Six people, were they, you're talking about, are you talking about law enforcement or
no,
just?
No, six people who had information on the case, who were questioned in the case, or who were people of interest in the case or witnesses. Have disappeared, or not disappeared, but died.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, and that's, anytime you take a group of people who are in a high risk demographic, a decade later, you can say that, right?
Yeah.
And then once again, that's a situation where if you choose your targets carefully, then you can easily explain it all afterwards.
Well, one of the things that I find disturbing about Ryan Snowberger, because again, the last people to see him alive, I think, were the people that were involved in the Rainbow family.
Mm-hmm.
Is we just covered a case where the Robert Fisher, who took off, he killed his entire family but took his dog. Well, Robert Snowberger, he had his dog with him, but then he disappeared but left his dog.
Left his dog. And never would. Everyone said he never would.
Same thing with Robert Fisher. And I think, you know, he took his dog. He murdered his own family and then took the dog. So here's a situation where I find that to be a little more disturbing, because now it adds a different aspect to me, because it's like, that almost appears to be a disappearance where something mysterious or something sinister happened to him, because his dog is still there, but he's not. And I find that odd, because my dogs go with me wherever I go, whether it's to the store, whatever. If I'm home and they got a chance to go, they're going.
And in Lacey's case, so many people via email and then also just like online said that her three daughters were her ground. You know, they were her stabilizing unit. If anything was stabilizing in her life, it was the three girls. There's no way she would have left them. So it's not like she took off, right? Because that's always the thing when you have these cases, like, oh, the person took off. She wasn't going to leave those three girls from everything that I've got.
Okay, so what I want to do right now is kind of like wrap this up in a nice little package for our listeners. So the Ocala National Forest.
Yeah.
It's 607 square miles of forest in central Florida. And what we're focusing on in this episode really is the Rainbow People, but not so much the Rainbow People themselves, but others who are posing as Rainbow People and causing trouble. Now, we've gone over two missing people, Robert Snowberger and Lacey Buenafil.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's two people who have disappeared that we feel are connected to the Rainbow People.
That the people involved with the case, the people close to them, reached out to me to say that they felt the Rainbow People were involved. That's an important distinction to make. It's not me looking at dots on a map saying, you know?
Yeah. So we don't have proof or anything.
Right.
Okay. All right. I just, but we're have, about facts.
But we but have it speaks leads. To the mindset of the yes. people who live in Ocala and in the shadow of the Ocala as to the influence of this group.
So it's a direction to start.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's wrap up part one and then get back at you guys tomorrow for part two. We're going to continue talking about the Ocala National Forest with Chris. And we've got a lot more stuff to talk about. So
all of us can agree, and you including Chris, it's 607 square miles of mystery.
No, it's much more than that. Because once you get out of the forest, you still have the surrounding towns that consider themselves part of the Ocala that are not part of that geographic designation.
Well, let's get into that tomorrow. So everyone, that's going to be it for tonight.
Again, if you'd like to support the show, please subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/palmhawkmedia. That's PALMAHAWK media.
And of course, be sure to check out our website for links to all of our social media, Patreon, merch store, and much, much more.
And please make sure to subscribe to the show on whatever platform you're listening and rate and review. Please, 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 please. This really helps us branch out and reach a wider audience.
I don't know where we are, but I found somewhere I read that once you hit 200 reviews, that's when you really start to hit the pinnacle of referrals where they start putting you out front and center. So
I think we have like 193.
Ooh, let's get there. Let's get there. Help us out. We need 7 more reviews. So please come there and rate and review us.
And we want to give Chris Balzano a huge thank you for joining us tonight on this episode about the Ocala National Forest.
Check out his book.
Haunted
Ocala National Forest.
Haunted Ocala National Forest.
And of course, also check out the podcast.
And check out the pod, Tripping on Legends.
Tripping on Legends. I don't think we said it. Yeah, the podcast is Tripping on Legends.
And you got a Facebook page, everything, right?
Yeah, Facebook.com/Tripping on Legends.
Well, we're going to be tagging him in his Facebook and all of our promos for this episode. So, you guys, if you haven't already, because Chris has been on the show, what, 3 or 4 times now?
Third time, yep.
So, anyway, check out Chris. We'll be back at you tomorrow for part 2 of the Haunted Ocala National Forest. And thank you for listening to Paradise After Dark.
Dark, 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 dark.